WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook.
And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effect your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. This evening's show is going to be fully devoted to what is a very hot topic at this moment, nuclear power. It seems like any time energy production is discussed these days, nuclear power is going to be brought up in the mix. Whether it's the promise of these small modular reactors or the pronouncement by New York Governor Kathy Hochul that she wants to build a new nuclear plant in New York State, there is a lot of buzz and there are a lot of opinions around this issue. The question that we'll be addressing today is highly consequential, and that is whether nuclear energy is indeed worthy of being considered as a viable, clean energy solution, or whether nuclear, including that which is being called modern, is a technology that does not effectively address climate change, is still dangerous, is significantly too expensive to compete with clean energy technologies, and is therefore still best left in the past. Over the next 50 minutes or so, we're very fortunate to have with us someone who is extremely qualified to answer that question and give us the straight facts on nuclear energy. His name is Paul Gunter. He is a lead spokesperson in nuclear reactor hazards and security concerns. He acts as Beyond Nuclear's regulatory watchdog over the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear power industry. He has appeared on NBC Nightly World News, the Lehrer News Hour, BBC World News, and Democracy Now!, which of course airs immediately prior to this show, The Healthy Planet. He was a co-founder of the Anti-Nuclear Clamshell Alliance all the way back in 1976 to oppose the construction of the Seabrook, New Hampshire nuclear power plants through nonviolent direct action that launched the U.S. anti-nuclear movement. Prior to joining Beyond Nuclear, he served for 16 years as the director of the Reactor Watchdog Project for Nuclear Information and Resource Service. An environmental activist and energy policy analyst, he has been an ardent critic of atomic power developments for more than 50 years. Welcome to The Healthy Planet, Paul Gunter.
Thank you. How time flies.
Yeah, it's been a long time, and I'm going to start by thanking you so much for being really at the cutting edge, the forefront of awareness about the hazards of nuclear power for more years than many, probably most of our listeners, have been alive. And I'll also mention, as a point of interest, that one of the first actions that I took in what turned out to be my own lifetime-long environmental activism was to protest the opening of the Shoreham nuclear power plant on Long Island in the early 1980s. So we're coming full circle here for me.
No nukes.
Paul, I mentioned your affiliation with Beyond Nuclear. So tell our listeners something about the organization's mission and about the kind of work that it does.
Well, Beyond Nuclear was started in 2007. The idea was to make a broader, more clear connection between nuclear power and nuclear weapons and the need to abandon both. So that was principally the purpose of starting this 501c3. We got our tax-exempt status from Dr. Helen Caldicott, who had just retired to Australia. She was one of our co-founders as well. You know, we've got good credential.
That is a well-deserved retirement. Dr. Helen Caldicott has spoken at a Healthy Planet event. We know her work well. She's an amazing person and a lifelong educator and advocate for health and nuclear safety.
Indeed. And vigorous and dedicated.
So many years.
I would add that a lot of the work that we're doing right now is as a watchdog on Congress and particularly the White House. We've been engaged in litigation as well in a lot of licensing proceedings for nuclear power and nuclear waste issues. But we also cover things like radiation and health And we have an international program as well, Beyond Nuclear International. It has its own magazine-style website that carries the stories of nuclear power more on the line of human and animal interest.
All right, great. And I'll mention here that the website for Beyond Nuclear International is beyondnuclearinternational.org, beyondnuclearinternational.org. And Beyond Nuclear's website is beyondnuclear.org. Though before we delve into some of the facts and politics of nuclear energy, I'm going to ask you to go back some decades and give our audience a brief history of nuclear power in the U.S. And I know you've been observing this industry for decades, and you've had a front row seat, not only looking at it, but carefully observing it to see it unfold. You have a perspective on the history of the movement and the industry that not many others have. So talk about how long nuclear power has been around, when it peaked, that kind of thing, the recent pause for decades in construction, and then some of the recent issues such as happens in South Carolina and the Vogtle plant in Georgia, and ending with the state of the industry today. And of course, talk about your role and how you observe this growing nuclear movement from nothing to what it has become today.
Right. Wow. That's a stream of thought.
That's 50 years, right?
I started out by visiting the Enrico Fermi nuclear power station in just outside of Detroit when I was in high school. This would have been in the mid-1960s. And when I went to college in 1966, the Enrico Fermi nuclear power plant that I had visited had a minor meltdown and a nuclear accident that became a book by John Fuller called We Almost Lost Detroit. So that was my introduction to the fact that nuclear power that I had visited with people in white lab coats, very confident of their work, turned into a nuclear accident that we narrowly missed having our first Fukushima in the 1960s, but here in the United States instead of Japan. But I really came around to the issue in the 1970s. At that time, I was living in New Hampshire, and I was doing other nonprofit work, and I was approached by some folks who were concerned about that there was a Public Service Company of New Hampshire was looking to build two large nuclear power plants on a saltwater estuary on the Atlantic coast of New Hampshire in the little town of Seabrook, New Hampshire, which is primarily fishing and clamming and agriculture. And they had picked an Indian burial ground of all places to put this twin nuclear power station. And that raised a lot of concern along that spectrum. And by back then, this would have been 1975, you know, that we started organizing. Nuclear power, again, was still under the motto, too cheap to meter. President Nixon had just announced the Energy Independence Act to build 1,000 nuclear power plants in the United States by the year 2000. And starting out there on Seabrook. So, you know, we had learned enough through our experience in women's rights, civil rights, voters' rights, that the power of industry was mobilizing against us with more money. And we were also watching the Autobahn Society go through the legal process before the, then it was the Atomic Energy Commission to soon become the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But we resolved that there needed to be another front opened up on this industry that has all the lawyers. They fund both sides of the political spectrum. And we were also many of us experienced in nonviolent direct action. And so we set out to build a nonviolent direct action project that would evolve into the Clamshell Alliance. And we were, you know, very careful that this was not about an attack on property. This was not about an attack on police. This was about organizing a conversation and dialogue that was principled on getting to the truth. Even in the 1970s, we knew that there was no place to put all this nuclear waste that they were building. Some of us were aware that there had already been a near nuclear accident at the Browns Ferry fire in Alabama that was another near miss for a nuclear accident at this TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, a federal utility, and you know their project, where a worker looking for drafts in conduit systems was using a candle along these cable conduits under the control room when the flame of the candle got sucked in to the conduit and started a fire that destroyed the control cables to the control room of these reactors.
Wow.
And because it was an electrical fire, it was in an electrical circuits, the fire department and the TVA authorities were reluctant to put it out by water. So they burned most of the cable to the control room to shut the reactor down. But they were able to jerry-rig it so that they could shut the reactor down by what was recognized as a miracle. And narrowly avoided another accident. And this would have been in 1975. So we set about to be a counterpart to the legal intervention side, and we fully supported the Audubon Society and another group called the Seacoast Anti-Pollution League that began to engage in the litigation side of a licensing permit for the construction and eventually the operating license. By then, the Atomic Energy Commission had shut down by an act of Congress when they were abolished because they were too much of a promoter than a regulator. And that's when the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was established to separate the promotional side, which went to the Department of Energy, and the regulatory side, which went to the NRC. So the construction began in July of 1976. And on July 4th, we had prepared a declaration of nuclear resistance that laid out a set of principles, a conduct of action that we would carry out these civil disobedience. And we organized on a policy of consensus through small affinity groups. And the first affinity group of 18 folks, which I was one of, we walked out onto the construction site, which was basically clearing of the woods there. And we rededicated the site by burying corn and sunflowers and young maple saplings. We were arrested and held overnight. That really was the first action of the Clamshell Alliance. That was August 1st, 1976. On August 22nd, 1976, we had 188 people march out onto the site, organized by affinity groups. And then again, all arrested and held in armories and the county jails. And by May Day of 1977, we had 2,000 people organized in groups of 18 to 20, working on a consensus process through spokespeople that met in a decision-making body, or as we called it, the DUM. And we were making decisions that while we were occupying the construction site, a New England-wide composite of state police organized by New Hampshire Governor Meldrum Thompson basically tried to negotiate us off the site, but you know, we were camped. We intended to stay there until we could be relieved by another occupying group. And that was the succession of events that we were prepared to complete. But the state police and eventually the New Hampshire National Guard interrupted us and hauled us off. We were held in county jails and New Hampshire National Guard armories for 2 weeks because we refused to post bond. And finally, Governor Thompson and the authorities released us on our own recognizance. And then we had some trials after that. You know, by 1978, we had 20,000 people on the construction site that had been negotiated that we would be there for 3 days, hold a rally where Pete Seeger and a whole host of celebrities, Bonnie Raitt, we did a concert and speakers with Dr. Benjamin Spock and you know other authorities on radiation and safety. And we had a broad-based education that then spread out over the country and opened up resistance communities all the way over to, from coast to coast, out to Diablo Canyon in San Luis Obispo, California, down to the Catfish Alliance in Louisiana, over to Oregon, all over. But that was really the a thumbnail sketch of launching the American anti-nuclear movement that was based in this principle of to seek consensus on these nonviolent direct actions that put people at risk. And that's not to be taken lightly.
This is Bob DiBenedetto with the Healthy Planet radio show on WUSB 90.1 FM. We're speaking to Paul Gunter, Beyond Nuclear's regulatory watchdog over U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear power industry, an environmental activist and energy policy analyst, and an ardent critic of atomic power development for more than 50 years. You can find out more about Paul and Beyond Nuclear at www.beyondnuclear.org.
That's an amazing history that you just told us there.
It is.
Talk about grassroots.
It is. And we developed a lot of grass tops people out of that process as well, who later on went to become state legislators and you know, litigators. So it was an evolution and a sophistication. Meantime, the nuclear industry that had set out to have 1,000 nuclear reactors by 2000, they were having, by 1978, there were no new orders, simply because the cost projected between for Seabrook, or you know, when they opened construction, it was going to be $900,000 for two 1150 megawatt reactors. By the time we were engaged in 1978, it was already up to $5 billion. That was happening across the United States, an incredible cost escalation, and the lack of cost control was so out of control that there were no new orders placed after 1978. Actually, no plants ordered after 1973 were ever actually completed because of the escalation in cost. That issue has only become more of a problem for the ability of the industry to control this inherently dangerous technology, because there has to be so many inherent systems. You know, there are backup pumps to backup pumps. There are electrical cables to backup electric cables, you know, to make sure that multiple levels of safe shutdown are protected, to be reasonably assured that you're not going to let that critical reaction get out of control, because that's what happens when Fukushima happened. And but in the end, you know, of this generation two, which Seabrook was a generation two reactor, a pressurized water reactor like Shoreham reactor there on Long Island was,
right,
which closed again because of critical safety issues that you could not even be elected to dog catcher on Long Island if you were not opposed to the opening of that reactor. So there were a lot of political consequences to the economic meltdown that occurred far in advance of Three Mile Island meltdown that happened in 1979. So the building had stopped, the new applications had stopped. So when Three Mile Island came along, that was sort of the nail in the coffin for even thinking about building new ones. And the idea was now trying to get the old ones construction completed. But again, they were closing. So, you know, for the example of Shoreham was offered at $65 million for one 800 megawatt reactor there on in Suffolk County. And when it was, that would have been 1965 when it originally got its application in. By the 1980s, it was up to $5.5 billion for that same unit. Mm. That was what, that's when they finished construction at Shoreham, it was $5.5 billion. So, you know, a billion is 1,000 millions. So that just goes to show you just how out of control this this technology had become. Nearly as many plants that were started were canceled as were finally completed. There were only about 135 of Richard Nixon's 1,000 reactors that were actually operating by 2000. So again, what was supposed to be a boon became a bust. And it was the largest managerial disaster in U.S. business history, as recorded by, you know, the business journals. And it was also proven not to be inherently safe with Three Mile Island. You know, luckily, that plant had only been online for 3 months when it had an accident in 1979. And a $900 million plant was turned into a $1 billion cleanup cost. Mm. So to cut to the chase, there was a long respite, no construction. There were plants aging. By 2005, the industry had mobilized again to organize what they were looking at as a nuclear renaissance, as it was called. Congress was mobilized. And they streamlined the licensing process, and they set out to build a generation three of nuclear power plants. But of the 35 plus units that marshaled to risk going through the licensing process and the financing, only two were actually completed. So the renaissance became a relapse of what we'd been seeing for decades, which sort of brings us to today with, again, the nuclear industry mobilizing Congress in 2022 to 2024 and the passage of the ADVANCE Act by a nearly unanimous Congress. Both Democrats and Republicans supported a renaissance too of new reactors. Again, these are particularly for the small modular reactors, as they're referred to as SMRs, we see them as small mirage reactors with the inability to actually comprehend what it's going to cost when you abandon the economies of scale that they thought they could achieve by building huge reactors. Now they're going to do it on little reactors, which are going to be more, even more costly per kilowatt hour. And again, these are novel technologies. Some of them that are being commercialized for export around the world. These are also dual purpose reactor designs from the 1950s that were for originally making nuclear weapons material and turned into using the byproduct of that heat process to make plutonium can now be used to make electricity. So several of the reactors that are now being proposed for licensing are models that bring a clear and present threat with the proliferation of nuclear weapons as they become exported by American companies.
And you mentioned that they're more expensive per kilowatt hour than the big nuclear plants. And it should be mentioned that the big nuclear plants are incredibly expensive, which has been one of the thorns in their side, is that they create the plants and they have cost overruns. You mentioned them back in the 1900s, but the same thing is happening now. We have two very recent examples of that in South Carolina and Georgia.
Exactly. So again, this generation three, and these are supposedly advanced reactors. So Vogtle 3 and Vogtle 4 were two of the 12 Westinghouse AP1000 pressurized water reactors. Of those 12 that were Westinghouse, of the 35 that were offered, only four were advanced to financially make the application process. Two in Georgia, Vogtle 3 and 4, and two in V.C. Summer in South Carolina. V.C. Summer, again, AP1000s, they were canceled because at less than 50%, because they'd already exceeded $10 billion in sunk cost that was stuck on the ratepayers without a watt of benefit. And Vogtle 3 and 4 were completed 6 to 7 years late. And what was offered to ratepayers at the beginning in 2007 at $14 billion, by 2024, it was $36
billion. Wow.
So it more than doubled in this exorbitant fleecing. And in the VC Summer case in South Carolina, one of the CEOs for the operating utility that was sponsoring it went to federal prison for on wire fraud because they cheated the South Carolina Public Utility Commission by false documentation that didn't really accurately document how badly they had lost control of the construction project.
You know, in Georgia, I've heard that referred to as the most expensive electricity on the planet.
There's competition, particularly in England, where we're seeing cost of, again, two large reactors for $54 billion, and they're not complete.
It's really something. Massive cost overruns are not an anomaly with nuclear power. They are the norm for modern nuclear power.
To go from too cheap to meter to too costly to matter, that's been the story of nuclear power.
Consistently.
And that's not going to change overnight.
Right. Consistently too expensive. And it's amazing that we keep talking about it and it keeps coming up as if it's going to be the solution, the cost-effective solution for the future, when the old story just keeps repeating itself. They say it's going to cost one thing and it just costs way more, not to mention that it costs a whole lot more than clean, renewable energy and energy efficiency by a long shot.
Exactly. I mean, solar right now is $35 per megawatt hour. And nuclear is $148 per megawatt hour. I mean, and these are average. You know, now utilities are generating solar power as utility grade manufacturing. And again, with the renewable side now, there are also other savings, not only financially, but wind and solar power do not require large quantities of water. One of the big concerns about particularly these AP1000 reactors and reactors like Seabrook. Well, Seabrook was going to take in, for two reactors, it was going to take in 3.5 billion gallons of water out of per day out of the Atlantic. And that would be bringing, you know, that's a, again, this, these reactors were located on a marine estuary. So there, this is a breeding ground for fishery
right.
culture. So those fish, the spawn, you know, they're pasteurized when they come, when they're just sucked directly into these reactors. And that's the once through cooling system that just discharges it as then super hot water back into that receiving water. So there's that feature.
You're listening to Bob DiBenedetto in our interview with Paul Gunter, Beyond's Nuclear's regulatory watchdog over the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear power industry. An environmental activist and energy policy analyst, he has been an ardent critic of atomic power developments for more than 50 years. Beyond's Nuclear's website is www.beyondnuclear.org. Back to our interview with Paul Gunter on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook.
You know, there some of the new systems, these novel systems that are coming out right now, they're not cooled by water. They're using liquid metal. One of those liquid metals is sodium. They superheat sodium, which is then pumped into from the reactor where it's heated, and then through a steam generator, where the piping that's with the liquid sodium runs parallel to piping with water, that then the heat is transferred. It turns the water side to steam for the turbines and the generators to make electricity. Well, what happens if there's a crack between the sodium side and the water side in those steam generators? When you mix sodium and water, it becomes explosive. So a lot of these SMRs are tangling with some very dangerous chemistry on assurances that they're not going to have that crack that allows the sodium leakage to mingle and explode with the water side. You know, one of the big concerns that got us mobilized was that back in 1959, the nuclear industry could have not licensed the first reactor were it not for the fact that Congress passed the Price-Anderson Act, which allows for the limited liability to be established in the event of a nuclear accident on the utilities. So they're not held for the full financial cost of a nuclear accident. Back then, it was $500 million in 1959. That was the cap that was set for the industry. Today, it's $16.6 billion. And that was the act that was passed in the Advance Act of 2024. It extended Price-Anderson limited liability coverage from a severe accident from an industry that is still claiming to be inherently safe.
Right.
And but it's not safe enough for the industry to risk their own liability, like every other industry, to pay the cost of doing inherently dangerous business. So Price-Anderson went through Congress without one public hearing, through both the House and the Senate. It was the Price-Anderson Act was passed as a tag-on legislation to the National Defense Fund. The National Defense was contingent upon getting the nuclear industry limited liability coverage. So they also raised it so that the nuclear industry is now covered until 2065 if they have an accident over the next 40 years. They don't have to worry about paying it. And, you know, $16.5 billion, that sounds like a lot of money. Chernobyl is upwards of $700 billion right now, and it's still not cleaned up. Fukushima Daiichi in Japan from the 2011 accident is now upwards of $400 billion, and it's still not cleaned up. This is why the industry would not be building these things if they had to put their own financial skin in the game for something that's as dangerous and consequential as a nuclear accident.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we could end the interview here, Paul, because if you're looking at an industry that will not take on the responsibility of covering the worst case scenario, which we know what can happen, and yet they continue to say that it's safe, it just boggles the mind that one could look at that industry and say, yeah, it is safe. Let's talk about what happens in the worst case scenario. Let's say we had a nuclear plant on Long Island. It was flooded because of some bizarre tidal wave, or it was the target of a terrorist attack. What would happen? What would the people of Long Island or any other city need to do in the worst case scenario that the nuclear industry is not willing to cover with their own money? Because this is a possibility.
And it's not remote enough that the industries or the insurance industry, for that matter, your homeowner policy, your car insurance is exempted from a nuclear accident as well. Let's get another bird with this stone. The issue of climate change right now, particularly for, let's say, Long Island, it's an unknown really right now. The U.S. nuclear industry and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission are not licensing nuclear reactors or extending operator licenses for nuclear reactors with any analysis that looks at what the projected consequence of climate change will bring on nuclear accident frequency and the consequences. So even though it's widely recognized that by 2050, we're going to see coastal states faced with unprecedented flooding, unprecedented storm surge, we could see Category 6 hurricanes by then. And the NRC licensing system, which Governor Hochul is talking about engaging in, presently does not look at what climate change is going to do to Lake Ontario and the coastal siting of her new reactor and the five reactors that are already there and operating and extending their operating licenses out to 80 years. So they're going to fall right into the zone of the impact of climate change. But the NRC is not considering it. In fact, there was a U.S. Government Accountability Office report that came out on April 2nd, 2024. It focuses on the fact the GAO says that, and they told us to Congress, that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has to look at climate change in its licensing process for things like flooding, sea level rise, wildfires, unprecedented severe just weather, you know, atmospheric rivers right now,
yeah,
which can bring 23 inches of rain within a matter of hours. It would not, even that would not be unprecedented, but it's going to get worse. And those kinds of consequences, particularly with the plants that were built in the 1960s and 1970s, they never even contemplated this. But it's not being incorporated into the design features of new reactors. And they're going to be locating these new reactors in larger density populations. That's the whole point of having a small modular reactor. You can put it in a large density municipal district. And again, with the no confidence that the industry has, we can only assume that they're better informed than what they're letting on about what the consequences of that accident would be. And what we have seen is that the loss of cooling, whether it be the loss of water, the electricity to pump water, or the loss of electricity to pump sodium or to provide emergency power to safe shutdown systems, that means that these reactors will overheat. And when you overheat, there can be any number of things. They can explode. In Fukushima's case, it was the melted fuel interacted with the zirconium steel cladding of the fuel rod assemblies. Zirconium is the stuff that you put in flash powder for your flash bulbs. Zirconium, when it's powdered, it's also used in military munitions for explosives. The current reactors use zirconium cladding wrapped around these uranium fuel pellets that when they overheat, this stuff ignites. The zirconium cladding ignites and it burns in what's called an exothermic reaction that causes water to elementally separate into hydrogen and oxygen. And when you have hydrogen free form and oxygen free form, all it needs is a spark. That's what we saw on March 12th and 13th, following the March 11th tsunami and earthquake that destroyed the three reactors at Fukushima. And that's at the reactor core of every operating nuclear power plant, including those five that are on the shore of Lake Ontario, on the coast of New York there. So once the reactors are breached, then it's just a question of how much nuclear fuel is involved. At Three Mile Island, which was only a small portion of the fuel, there were radioactive readings from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, that were recorded in Portland, Maine. It went up a narrow stream, but there was a radioactive release in 1979 that we believe are still resulting in leukemias. While they will say that, you know, nobody's died from nuclear power, well, people are still having leukemia. The etiology for that leukemia is hard to trace to a neutron particle that was released from a nuclear accident, but that's the same case in Fukushima. It's certainly the case in Chernobyl, where radioactive fallout shut down the sheep industry in Scotland and northern Wales for more than a decade and shut down Laplanders grazing of reindeer in Norway for more than a decade. And it's still not clean. You know, those countries, those governments, they simply raised the protective allowable radiation exposure that the public is allowed to get because the land is too contaminated to run by the former standard. And that's what's happened. The same is true in Japan now. What was one millisievert is now 20 millisieverts.
As regarded as being safe.
As regarded as being safe.
Right, and they up the standard. Right.
There is no safe level, particularly when the safe level standard is in itself antiquated. You know, we're still measuring safety for public exposure based on a 25-year-old male who's at the prime of his life and, you know, a worker in a nuclear power plant. And yet the most vulnerable population is the pregnant woman or her fetus or the children. And the current standard is not protective enough for children, particularly because, you know, their thyroids are still developing faster. Their cellular work is still building faster than an adult. So radiation goes after the quick-growing cells. That's why it's used in cancer treatment, because it attacks the quick cell growth. So that's basically a child. And so those exposure levels are not, they're not equivalent for a protective level for a child, an infant, or a pregnant woman, by what's being used right now for licensing these nuclear power plants and establishing standards for, hey, when are we going to evacuate this population? And when can you come back? Evacuation isn't necessarily return. You know, there's still a 36-mile diameter around Chernobyl that is unoccupiable. There's still an 18-mile radius around Fukushima, which is not considered safe enough for return. You know, there are some limited pockets where people are going back in, but again, they're going back into this raised standard, not the former protective level pre-Fukushima. So there's a lot of monkeying around going here with both licensing standards, protective standards, and actual consequence.
And you look at that, and those areas are uninhabitable. You say for 18 miles, 36 miles, whatever it happens to be. Again, consider that that happens in a population center. The price that would have to be paid by the public for a form of energy that is unnecessary, that is more expensive, that is deadly in its own right in terms of using substances that are deadly. Whether you like it or not, whether you think it's going to escape from that atmosphere or not, it's deadly and it's dangerous. Again, with the fact that they can't even cover their own insurance, it's so dangerous. Meanwhile, we have alternatives. You're listening to the Healthy Planet radio program. This is Bob DiBenedetto interviewing Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear. I'd like to get your take on this. Kevin Camps, a radioactive waste specialist for Beyond Nuclear, who also spoke at one of our events, said that nuclear is not clean. He said it's been called clean. It's been called safe. It's been called cost-effective, none of which are true. These are Orwellian lies. Given the issues that you've been talking about, I have to ask a basic but important question, and that is, given that it's objectively more expensive and it has these inherent dangers, why are today's politicians so much behind this? Why are they viewing this as being the solution to the exclusion of all others at this point, where they're painting renewable clean energies as being somehow un-American, and they're looking at nuclear and fossil fuels as being saviors in some way? How does this happen? What are they thinking? Do they have families that they're thinking about? Or how do they not think about their families? Or do they just not know? What's your take on that?
I think it's the entry of politics that supersedes, you know, the wisdom of a sustainable system. You know, you lay out a very, very interesting picture there of how illogical it is. Well, it becomes more illogical when you look at the United States Energy Information Agency. Their statistics right now are showing that 95% of new electrical generating capacity in the United States is coming from renewable energy.
Right.
95% of new electrical energy generation capacity, and this will be this year and next year, will come from renewable energy, predominantly solar power, which is reliably deployable. It deploys quickly, it deploys on cost, and it deploys with less environmental footprint. And, you know, wind and solar do not use large amounts of water, which again is going to be a climate change issue. The Trump administration, in its big, beautiful bill that just passed, eliminated tax credits for solar and for wind. It's gone.
Talk about illogical.
Let me make it clear. Renewable energy can be built without subsidies. It's market competitive now without subsidies. But the idea, in particularly in face of climate change, is to accelerate the deployment of carbon reduction at the least cost, quickest. And that was the idea behind the production tax credits and the finance tax credits going for solar and wind, is to get it out there quickly, more carbon reduction, least cost, and deploys reliably. You know, again, you can't compare that to the nuclear industry's last try at building. They had 35 reactors that pledged to build, only two completed, and they completed more than twice the original estimated cost and 7 years behind schedule. That is the death knell for climate mitigation. We don't have time. We don't have the time to waste more money.
Every dollar that goes toward nuclear in the name of climate change and mitigating the gases that are put out by fossil fuels is a dollar taken away from the industries that actually do that job and that actually save all of us money. I'm benefiting from that solar tax credit. I live in a house where I have no electricity bill. Meanwhile, I have a family member who lives a few blocks away from here who pays $600 a month. And our house is larger than theirs.
Exactly.
And this is the result of a very successful public policy that they would look to accelerate the adoption of these clean energy, money-saving energy technologies. And it worked. So many of us are benefiting from it. But it worked too well because obviously they think they would like to see the money going towards something that's expensive and dangerous for who knows what reason, political or monetary.
Yeah. And, you know, they're dismissing renewables because they're saying that they're still arguing that it's interim.
Oh,
you know, that, you know, yeah. Look, you know, you're not going to be, you know, Trump even said in one of his stump speeches that you're not going to be able to watch television at night.
Right.
You know, I mean, how
he just makes things up.
Dumb
yeah.
Does that have to be? Again, this is more than just politics. When we're talking about climate change, this is a dangerous act of fraud.
Yeah.
And that, in fact, it's not misinformation, it's deliberate disinformation. And that's the current struggle, that we have to look at this conundrum right now. And again, you know, Democrats as well as Republicans need to be read the Riot Act on this. I mean, Governor Hochul is talking about diverting state spending into a nuclear rat hole that we already know is unpredictable in the reliability of completion or how much it's actually going to cost in the end. And it's not going to give you the carbon reduction that you would get with renewable energy. That's the fraud side of this.
And she's looking to streamline the permitting process.
Yeah. That's if we're going to streamline it, let's do it for something, again, that's most carbon, least cost, reliably deployable. That's how you make climate change mitigation effective policy.
Right. Well,
we're doing the reverse.
Yeah, we are. And the more you know about this topic, the more you have to just throw up your hands and scratch your head and say, nothing is making sense right now. The people that we elect as leaders, we expect to have foresight and vision and look at the big picture and make decisions that benefit us. But that's the opposite of what's happening. The only thing that's being benefited now is their personal power, their political connections, the money we know they're receiving from both the fossil fuel industry and the nuclear industry, is leading people to not think. So our government is broken right now. That's not a partisan judgment. It's a fact. The more facts you know, you see that things aren't working the way a government, in our vision of what a government should be working as. It's just not happening.
And it's anti-democratic.
Oh,
that's
absolutely.
Which, you know, brings us to, you know, you know, what would be the new Tea Party if we were to look at our revolutionary history, you know, particularly when you're talking about electricity rates, I think it'd be a good, you know, and to take the idea of civil disobedience, a nonviolent civil disobedience to an equal level. You know, we should start thinking about everybody taking the irate payer pledge. You know, we should be irate. All rate payers should be irate and take it to the next level that we're not only not going to take it anymore, we're not going to pay for it anymore.
Mm.
That's really the level that we have to start thinking on. And this is where we were at in 1975, you know, that we can't expect a bipartisan Congress, which is funding nuclear power and watching renewable energy being strangled in front of us. You know, that should not stand.
It should not. It really shouldn't. Paul, we're out of time.
I'll ask you if you have any final thoughts to leave our audience with before we wrap this up.
Well, I think it's consistent to say no nukes. No nukes is also means that no more nuclear waste. We didn't really get the chance to talk about the fact that what Hochul is proposing is to increase the amount of unmanaged nuclear waste in the state of New York. It has no place to go. And so the generator is going to be responsible for it. And as well, again, please realize that the designs these reactor developers are talking about right now, when they talk about exporting nuclear power with sodium-cooled reactors, they're talking about handing bomb-prone nuclear fuel over to other countries and would-be nuclear weapons producers. I mean, not that we have the right to continue that suicide mission here, but exporting dual-purpose reactors for profit, that again is not acceptable.
Yeah. There's so much we could talk about. We could go another two shows.
Exactly.
I will invite you back. All right, Paul. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate all you've done for so many decades. You've done your work, and all of us really should be grateful to you.
I'm happy to be here still, and I will reincarnate.
Great. All right. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Well, this is again Bob DiBenedetto with the Healthy Planet Radio Show on WUSB 90.1 FM. We've been speaking to a legend in the anti-nuclear movement, Paul Gunter, Beyond Nuclear's regulatory watchdog over the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear power industry, an environmental activist, and an energy policy analyst. He's been an ardent critic of atomic power development for more than 50 years. Find out more about Paul and Beyond Nuclear at www.beyondnuclear.org. And that'll do it for this evening's show. I do want to sneak in a few words of support for all of you environmentally aware people out there. And I know there are a lot of us who right now feel like your world is falling apart. And I'm not saying this lightly. I'm talking about the ongoing attacks by this administration on every aspect of the environment. The attack is widespread, from public lands to our air to our water to climate protections and even acknowledging climate change. My message to you is stay strong, don't give up hope, keep active. Eventually, this will turn around because the mission we have is valuable and it is also logical. Everybody wants clean water, clean air, a clean environment, but they just need to be put in touch with the fact that we can do that if we act together. We have the technology, we have the wherewithal, and we have the wisdom to do so. Unfortunately, that wisdom is not shared by the people in power at this moment. That's it. Stay strong, stay active, don't give up hope. Join us again by tuning in on the second Friday of each month at 6 p.m. For more info on Healthy Planet, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org. Until next time, stay strong, relax, continue to make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak up for what's right. Consider being kind to those around you, including our amazing four and multi-legged friends. And remember to enjoy every moment of existence on this beautiful planet that we all share and that's worth fighting for. Good night.
I love this song.
I love nachos.
Loving everything? You might be buzzed.
You know what I'd love? A ride when it's time to head out.
If you see a buzz warning sign, call for a ride when it's time to go home. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.